Yes, I'm going to give a review talk on gravitational cell force, or as I like to put it, I'm going to give an introduction to everybody else's Kepler talk so that all the other people don't have to. So let's get started. So cell force is all about modeling relativistic binaries. And essentially there's three main approaches that start from first principles that can model relativistic binary systems. First of all, and probably the oldest, almost certainly the oldest, is weak field approximations, where you expand your field in the weak field and you can do calculations analytically. But the leading order of this would simply be our familiar Newtonian dynamics for binaries. And then you get post-Newtonian corrections. This works very well in the weak field, but as you get into the strong field, because the post-Newtonian series is an asymptotic series, it doesn't actually converge at any finite radius. So as you keep adding more post-Newtonian modes, at some point, it is going to diverge. And this is going to get worse the further on you are in the strong field regime. The other very well-known approach is to just put Einstein's equations on a grid and solve everything numerically. So this will give you numerical relativity. This also has been very successful and has been one of the pillars of modeling relativistic binaries, but this is also very expensive. This requires supercomputers to do any single simulation and may take weeks or even months for a single simulation running on the supercomputer. And this means that it has certain limitations. In particular, a numerical relativity simulation is simply limited in how many cycles it can do of an interval. I think sort of the most it has been done is around 100. However, and as I hope most people that are here are familiar with, if you go to the small mass ratio regime, these systems can spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cycles in the strong field regime where they can't be modeled by the weak field methods. But certainly you also can't model that many cycles in numerical relativity simulations. To make things worse, it actually becomes more expensive to model each individual cycle. So numerical relativity simulations are limited in the length of the simulation and in the mass ratio that we can reach. So if we look at this diagram here, where we have compactness vertically, and we have the mass ratio horizontally, numerical relativity lives in this lower left corner, while weak fields, post-Newtonian and post-Minkowskian methods live at the top of the diagram. However, later in the week, see Hannes Rutter talk about how one way they're looking into of making numerical relativity simulations work for smaller mass ratios. So what can you do when you have a system with a very small mass ratio? Say an extreme mass ratio in spiral where you have a stellar mass object spiraling into a supermassive black hole. In that case, we can again do perturbation theory. In this case, perturbation theory with the mass ratio as the small parameter. Ultimately, it leads to a combination of numerical and analytical techniques, which are all based around doing black hole perturbation theory. And this is why we're all here this week. The leading order of this approximation will just be geodesics moving in a black hole background. And one of the nice aspects is that this is the only of the first principle methods that really allows in principle to do simulations all the way from the weak field to the in-spiral merger phase. So let's move on to how sort of the typical canonical setup that we want to look at. And let me move my things there in the way. So the typical setup or problem that we want to look at is a extreme mass ratio in spiral. And this consists of a primary object, which will pretty much always be a curved black hole. And we'll have a typical mass around a million solar masses. A million solar masses because this puts it right in the center of the sensitivity band, LISA, the space-based barometer. And we'll denote the spin by A1. And there will be a secondary object, which we will require to be compact, but not necessarily a black hole. So it could be a black hole, a neutron star, a white dwarf, or maybe even some exotic compact objects with mass M2. And that mass will be typical of the 1 to maybe 30 solar masses. And we require it to be compact, meaning that the size of the object is of the same order as its mass, maybe with a factor of few. And one of the things that that means is that, for example, the spin of the object is limited to be itself a order M2 quantity. And furthermore, any higher multiple moments will be suppressed by higher powers of the mass ratio. Further notations and conventions. G is C is 1. I don't know what else you could ever put these as, but 1 is, of course, a nice number. Q is the mass ratio, which for me will be the smaller mass divided by the bigger mass. So Q is a small number, and typically around sort of 10^-5. And we'll also regularly encounter the symmetric mass ratio, which is a combination of the masses, which if you expand in powers of Q is also order mass ratio. So if something is first order in normal mass ratio, it is also a first order quantity in symmetric mass ratio. If it's a second order mass ratio quantity, it's second order in the symmetric mass ratio. So let's dive into what this self-force business is all about. And the way things are set up is that we look at our primary and our secondary black hole. And if we zoom in on the secondary, because spacetime is locally flat, the spacetime near the secondary will look like the geometry generated by the secondary, plus some small perturbations due to the fact that the object is immersed in a larger curved spacetime. Conversely, if we go far away from the secondary, not necessarily far away from the primary, end up in what we would call the far zone, we would expect the geometry to be dominated by the primary. So it would be approximately the curved geometry of the primary, plus small perturbations due to the fact that there's a secondary floating around somewhere. And in each of these zones, in principle, you can write down the most general solution to your Einstein's equations. But typically, these will be underdetermined because you have a boundary between these two areas. However, you can look at the regime where both approximations hold. So this will be the matching zone. And there you can do a double expansion in both delta, the ratio of the distance of small things to a bigger mass, and in the mass ratio, and match these two solutions together. But this is the method of matched asymptotic solutions. And this teaches us a number of things. And essentially what this will give us is it will give us coupled equation for the metric in the far region and a effective world line for the secondary in that far metric. So we'll have an effective world line and we'll have a metric, and these are called. At leading order, we get a very simple and for most people familiar result. Is that if we go all the way to the limit where the mass ratio is equal to 0, the metric will simply be given by the current metric, and the particle, the secondary will follow a test particle trajectory. So it will follow a geodesic. Moving on to the next order, what you find from this procedure is that we can find or first order metric perturbation by putting in a point mass of the mass of the secondary that is following the effective world line. Of course, if you do that, that thing will be singular on the world line because we put in the point mass. And where a lot of the magic happens in the self-force method is that we can split this first order metric perturbation in a singular part and a regular part, where the regular part is a solution to the vacuum Einstein equation. And that this split works in such a way that the singular part does not contribute to the equations of motion for a world line, but for a second regular part does. More particularly, if we define an effective spacetime, which is just our curved background, plus this regular part of the first order metric, the effective world line will simply be a geodesic. And if we have and if the secondary doesn't have any spin, it would simply follow that geodesic. Or alternatively, if you would write this as a world line in the background current metric, you would find that it is the geodesic equation plus an effective force term that is forcing us off that geodesic. That effective force term is called the gravitational self-force. If the secondary is in fact spinning, then there will also be terms that are coupling the spin of the secondary to the curvature of the curved background, leading to what is called a Matheson-Bach-Petrov-Dixon force. And from there on, we can move on to second order. At second order in the mass ratio, the second order metric perturbation will be sourced by the first order metric perturbation, the mass, and now also the spin of the secondary object. At this order, we can't actually simply put in a point source of any type. And what will happen is that we'll have to solve directly for the regular metric perturbation using is called an effective source method, which I'm hoping Adam will cover a little bit on Wednesday, because I'm not going to go into the actual details of that here. And again, what we see is that if we write down an effective metric that takes these regular parts and adds it to the background, the effective world line will follow a geodesic there with corrections due to the spin and the quadrupole moments, and now also the quadrupole moment of the secondary coupling to the background. And this gives us a set of equations of motion for our binary. However, this isn't the full story yet, because we would have to evolve the equation of motion to get a solution for our INSPAR. And here one can follow one of two basic approaches. Either you could take this set of coupled equations and try to evolve it self-consistently in the time limit. So at every time step, you would both update the metric that everything is moving in, and you would update the world line. This has two potential issues. One is that it would be incredibly expensive computationally. But more importantly, it will be very hard to keep such a time domain simulation actually stable over 100,000 or a million cycles. So even if you can do the self-consistent evolution, you would probably still be limited in the mass ratio in the similar way that numerical relativity is. People have looked at this, for example, Peter Diener, whose face I can just about see on my list. Hi, Peter. Has looked at this in the past in the scalar case, but the second approach is what by now is the more popular and common today. And here we're again, going to take advantage of the fact that the mass ratio is a small number. Because not only does the mass ratio being a small number lead to a separation of length scales, but it also leads to a separation of time scales. The amount of energy that the system loses in each orbit, or more particularly the amount of specific energy that the system loses in particular orbits, is proportional to the mass ratio. So to lose a certain amount of specific energy requires a number of orbits that is inversely proportional to the mass ratio. So this means that the time scale for single orbits is much smaller than the time scale that the entire n spiral takes to complete. And we can take advantage of that. We can try to split the dynamics in dynamics that happen on this orbital timescale, and then on secular dynamics that happen on this n spiral timescale. This approach has several advantages. And the main one being is that we can now calculate the strain and the gravitational cell force by looking at snapshots of the system, by which I mean we start looking at the zeroth order solution, the geodesic. We can put that geodesic into our first order equations and calculate the first order metric. And we then can take that first order metric and put that into the equations to get a second order metric and a second order cell force. And we can do this at all points in our spacetime, fill our spacetime data, and then we can have a very robust and efficient way of evolving an n-spiral, while only having the cost, the very expensive cost of calculating the cell force only once. So it is this second approach that most people are pursuing nowadays. When you do this, the fact that we have the separation of time scales means that when we expand the waveform, so the final product that we want to look at as an observable for LISA, in part of the mass ratio, its terms are somewhat mixed up compared to the terms that you would get for the equations of motion. In particular, we get that secular dissipative terms typically appear earlier in the expansion than their corresponding conservative oscillatory terms in the equation of motion. So what does this mean exactly? So if we look at the leading order waveform, so this is often called the adiabatic waveform. And at this order, you would expect that in the, of approximation, that the typical error we make in the phasing of the n spiral over an n spiral time scale is order mass ratio inverse. Actually, that is wrong. The error, that the typical accumulated phase over an n spiral is order. Yes, that's right. It's right on the slide. I said it. The accumulated phase at this order is proportional to the inverse mass ratio. And to do an adiabatic order evolution, we would need this snapshot strain of each geodesic. So the waveform at infinity generated by a point particle moving along each geodesic. And we would need the orbit average dissipative part of the first order cell force, or as people like to call this, the flux, even though it isn't quite clear whether these are actual fluxes, but they can have in common that they can all be calculated from the gravitational wave flux at infinity and down the horizon. Moving on to the next order, which will be the first post-adiabatic order of our waveform. At this order, there will be an additional accumulation of the phase. So this shouldn't hit error, this phase over n spiral that is proportional to the mass ratio to the zero. So this is essentially a constant amount. So it doesn't matter what the mass ratio of the system is, you will always make this error if you ignore the first order, the first both adiabatic order of your waveform. To get this, we will need, you would need the full first order gravitational cell force. You would also now need to orbit average dissipative parts of the second order cell force. And you know, also need corrections to the orbit due to the secondary spin. If we would go even one order beyond that, that part would only contribute a phase that is order Q. And to get that phase, you would need the complete second order cell force. You would need the dissipative parts of the third order cell force. You would need corrections due to both the spin and the quadrupole moments of the, object, the secondary objects. And you now also need the second order correction to the snapshot strain to get the waveform to this order. However, as said, at this order, the contribution is going to be order the mass ratio. So assuming that the mass ratio is small and that the coefficient of this term isn't very big, this is always going to be a very small contribution. And one would expect that one only needs the zero and first order parts of the waveform to get, for example, an Emery wave. And depending on how small this coefficient is, you might even get to comparable analysis. I'll get back to that shortly. However, this ignores one particular aspect that happens during instant, so-called orbital resonances. So an orbital resonance occurs when some combination of the orbital frequencies, so some combination of the radial frequency, so this is associated to the time scale, the radial motion of your binary and the polar motion, so this is the time scale that oscillates around the equator, and the azimuthal time scale, this time scale takes to go around the black once. If some combination of these frequencies, some integer combination of these frequencies vanishes. And what this does to the system is that it takes something which would normally be an oscillatory term in your evolution, and temporarily, as this thing, this combination goes to zero, that term transforms from being oscillatory into a secular effect that grows over time. And this type of episode introduces a new third time scale to the problem, because the time that you spend near this resonance is proportional to the inverse square roots of the mass ratio. And the fact that it introduces this third time scale means that it breaks for earlier two time scale expansion and that they need to be treated separately. Resonances come in various types and sorts and classifications. You can distinguish resonances from which combination of frequencies actually vanishes. So the classical one was the one that was identified by Flanagan and Hinderer, which coupled the radial to the polar motions, but you can also couple the radial motion to the azimuthal motions, or the azimuthal motions to the polar motion, or at higher orders, you could even have coupling between any of these three frequencies and the precession frequency of the secondary spin. The other way to distinguish between the different types of resonances is the thing that drives the resonance. Because a resonance only has an effect if there is something that was originally actually varying with this combination of frequencies. So one potential driver is the gravitational cell force itself. Gravitational cell force itself can will lead to oscillatory terms in your equation of motion, and you could have oscillatory terms with such a combination. Alternatively, if you have a external astrophysical perturbation, this could again lead to a driver to some resonance. Or, and I think in order of prior likelihoods, we could be looking at something which is actually a curved black hole, which would have different quadrupole moments in a different field, gravitational fields, which again would power potential resonances. Finally, we have a third way of distinguishing resonances dependent on how long the system stays near the resonance. And sort of the vanilla mode is that the system just evolves straight through the resonance. This is called a transient resonance and is the most studied. However, as anybody that is familiar with celestial dynamics of moons and planets, you can also have resonances that are sustained, where the dynamics of the resonance is so strong that the system gets locked in the resonance. For example, this is the case of the rotation of the moon and the orbit of the moon, and why we always say see approximately the same side of the moon. Similar resonance occur all the way through our solar system. I, in particular, looked at this, if this could happen in for gravitational self-force coupled resonances in embryos. And the answer is that even if the self-force dynamics were very strong enough to allow such locking to happen, which isn't clear that it does, this will be very hard to be created in nature, because it would essentially have to thread a needle in phase space to get in the locked situation in the first place. So what are the effects of a resonance? And here I'll just focus on the transient case. A resonant episode where the system evolves for a resonance will typically call also an effective kick to the orbital parameter, say the energy angular momentum of the system. And that kick is proportional to the inverse square root of the mass ratio and whatever small parameter is causing the mass, the resonance to begin with. So if we have a self-force powered resonance, epsilon will be Q, and we would get a kick that is order square root of Q. And as then the inspiral continues all the way to merger, any such kick to the orbital parameters will actually grow to a phase difference of epsilon divided by Q to the minus three pass. Or differently put, the contributions of resonances appear at a half post adiabatic order in the waveform. So they are even more important potentially than the first post-adiabatic corrections. Moreover, the actual size of these kicks, and particularly the sign of the kick, depends on the exact orbital phase as the system crosses through resonance. And this turns resonances into a type of phase microscope, where small phase differences in the evolution get amplified by the resonance. And this means that, for example, resonances play a very important role in future tests of GR. And at this Kepler, we'll see a couple resonance related talks. We'll see Zach later in the week. We'll see Lorenzo, and we'll see Gupta's talk, which I'm all looking very much forward to. But how many orders in this post-adiabatic expansion do we actually need? And as I said, this depends on how big the sizes of these coefficients are. And last year, I talked at Capra about this. We can actually look at how big these coefficients are by looking at at numerical relativity simulations and try to extract the sizes of these post-adiabatic parameters. The conclusion there is that at least for the quasi-circular non-spinning case that we looked at, is that the second post-adiabatic contributions to the waveform are exceedingly small. And we So the coefficients of these terms probably doesn't even make them that relevant at comparable masses. And we certainly don't have to worry about these terms for extreme mass ratio in spirals. Later this week, we'll see, or I think actually today, we'll see Anthony Ramos-Boades talk about extensions of this comparison to eccentric in spirals. Because obviously, we don't know how the quasi-circular case has been deceptive in the past and how good approximations work for it. It would be nice to see what happens for more generic systems. So now we know what we need to do. And we can move to the question, what has been done? And we'll start at the adiabatic order. In an adiabatic order, we need information about geodesics. Good news there is we completely know how to solve geodesics analytically in current baseline. And in particular, Eva Hartmann will give an invited lecture tomorrow morning, so I won't say much about that now. Both the strain and the fluxes can be solved by solving the Tucholsky equation and extracting the fluxes of the gravitational waves of Venti and the horizon. So this will give us the strain and fluxes of the systems, and we now have very mature codes to do so. And in fact, at this moment, I know three codes that can do completely generic EMRI geodesic flux calculations. So there's Scott Hughes's Gremlin code. There's the code of the Kyoto group, originally developed by Fujita et al. And then there's my code that runs arbitrary precision Mathematica, MSD, that can do very high precision things. And these codes will have to be used to fill the parameter space. So what has been, but as said, knowing how to calculate the fluxes isn't enough to actually get your in-spirals. We need coverage of our parameter space with flux and strain data. That then needs to be interpolated. And for that, you can generate the in-spiral trajectory, and then you can use the strain data to build a waveform. And until recently, this hadn't been done really for generic systems. So over the last year, we've seen the arrival of the fast EMRI waveforms package developed by Alvin Shiro, Michael Katz, Neil Warburton, I think Scott Hughes, probably forgetting somebody. And they have implemented this for currently non-spinning eccentric relativistic binaries. In the progress, however, they haven't had coverage of the entire parameter space for generic orbits in Kerr to the generic case. But they have produced the first generic adiabatic in-spiral by having targeted calculations along one in-spiral and demonstrated that their method works. Further on the week, we'll have some more talks about evolutions of adiabatic order, including Oli Islam's Sir Ichiro and Fischler's talk later, I think most of them today as well. A lot of the work of this community over the last two decades has been at solving the gravitational cell force at first order. So to give a quick overview, the first gravitational cell force calculation for a bound binary was by Brock and Sago in 2007 for a quasi-circular non-spinning system, which they then later followed up for eccentric non-spinning systems in 2011. In 2012, we went up to circular spinning non-processing systems by both the Milwaukee group and by Barak and Dolan. And then in the last 8 years, I contributed to this by extending everything completely generic spinning and processing eccentric systems. So we now know how to calculate first order gravitational cell force, and we know how to do this in various layers. We have different methods to do the regularization. So this is how do we extract this regular parts from the first metric. So there is the original MODESUM methods that Lior introduced, and that has been the workhorse for most calculations. There's effective source or so-called puncture methods that are becoming more popular now. And I'm very glad to see that there is progress talks on how to use Green's function methods to get the first order solvers coming later today. Then the methods differ in how they decompose or linearize Einstein equations. This can be done in the time domain, frequency domain. And furthermore, there's variations in what gauge to use. We can do calculation in Lorentz gauge, we can do things in Cauchy-Wheeler gauge, and we can see do calculations in the radiation gauge in Kerr by going through the Tsiolkovsky equation. And on all these topics, we'll see talks later in the week. And then there is the final frontier of self-force calculations, which is the second order self-force. This is needed for any consistent evolution of a one post-adiabatic waveform. Again, I'm simply going to refer to Adam's talk later in the week and just see the large list of people talking about second order stuff on Wednesday. Which promises to be exciting updates. Then finally, to complete a one post one post adiabatic order, you need the corrections for spin. Here again, you first need to know the leading order dynamics of the secondary spin to calculate this. This is simply parallel transport along your effective fault line, and this is now known in a closed analytic form. At the next order in the mass ratio, you will need to, you will get a correction to this equation of motion due to the regular field. Again, the spin is parallel transported in the effective metric now, or if you write it relative to the background metric, this induces a gravitational self-torque on the secondary. Calculations as now have mostly focused on calculating the gauge invariant part of the self-torque called the spin precession invariant. And this has been calculated for circular orbits in Schwarzschild, eccentric orbits in Schwarzschild, and circular equatorial orbits in Kerr. Big to-dos here are still doing the generic orbits in Kerr and also looking at the full gravitational self-torque that doesn't only include the changes to the spin precession, but also, for example, how the inclination of the secondary spin changes. The analytic form of these Matheson Papapetri-Dixon terms is well known, and there have been many studies of how they impact extreme maturation intervals. We'll have two talks this chapter about this again. And finally, there are then the corrections of the spin to the gravitational self, in particular to the fluxes. Since the secondary spin itself is order of the secondary mass, we only see effects of the secondary spin appear in the gravitational field at second order, but there they do contribute to the fluxes, and this has been calculated for circular orbits in Schwarzschild and eccentric equatorial orbits in Kerr, where we'll see a talk later this week. And we'll also see a talk that's looking at the conservative. Yeah, I'm almost not done. final part, and I'm going to skip the rest. To consistently evolve a in spiral at first post adiabatic order requires the second order cell force, which we don't currently have. But in the absence of that, we can actually still look at what the other pieces of the first post adiabatic dynamics contribute to an in spiral. So this has been done mostly for non-spinning binaries. This gives us an idea of how big the effect of this one post-adiabatic contribution is, or differently put, what the size of the coefficient of the term is. Later in the week, or also I think today, is we'll see Phil talk about extensions of this fur. If you want to do evolutions like this, if you use the full cell force, you would have to resolve each particular orbital cycle in cell force is slow and numerically unstable. If you would try to do it, however, this can be solved by using a near identity transform to make the evolution much more stable. But again, Phil will talk about the curve case. And I'm pretty much out of time, so I'm going to skip a couple of slides and move to the end.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Sorry for rushing you at the end, but very good.
No problem.
We did say we'd give you some leeway.
We're there to make sure that if I spoke too fast, I wouldn't run out of things to talk about.
Okay, good. So then I'll open up the floor. Do we have any questions for Martin? Maybe I could have let you keep talking because we're not having any questions pop up right now. Oh, we have one question. Oh, okay, now they're coming. Okay, so I'll ask to unmute Jiala Li. See if I can do this correctly. Jiala, you can ask your question whenever you're ready.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the great talk. I have a question about the self-consistent evolution part, because you mentioned there will be accumulating aurora if you solve for the 10 to the power 5 different orbits. So I was wondering, how do you compute the aurora? Because if you solve any other ordinary differential equation, there's usually some conservative term like energy or angular momentum that actually allow you to see how much aurora you have accumulated. But for this system, are there such quantities? Like, that's my question. Thank you.
So since self-consistent evolutions haven't been done at that scale, it's very hard to actually even ask that question. So one thing you simply could be comparing to get your error is compared to a two timescale evolution, which does in fact build on the fact that you have not conserved quantities, but you have quantities that are conserved on a geodesic level and only evolve due to the higher order terms. So you get these adiabatic invariants that change over the interval. But the statement I made was more general. In any time domain ODE solver or PDE solver, where you have to solve over that many oscillations, unless you have some type of symplectic solver that actually takes advantage of conserved quantities, you're going to accumulate a lot of error. Or you have to make incredibly small time steps, and then it will become incredibly expensive. Either way, that is not a way to get a efficient way of building in sparks. Still important to look at because it gives a important way to test, for example, your two timescale methods to see if they are actually consistent with things. So somehow the self-consistent approach is conceptually somewhat simple.
Okay, thank you.
And yes, Leo, you can also measure convergence by changing time steps.
Thank you, Leo, also. And thanks, Martin, and thank you for the question. Eva Hackman, I'm going to ask you to unmute now as well for your question.
Yeah. Hi, everybody, and thanks for this wonderful talk. Very clear. Thank you very much. My question is about the magnitude of the mass ratio. In the figure you showed in the very beginning, it was indicated that you can use this up to more than 10 to minus 2, yes, exactly. And you even mentioned equal mass ratios in the talk. So Can you apply this really to, say, pulsar, stellar mass, black hole binary, say, where you have a, say, pulsar, one solar mass pulsar and, say, 20 solar mass black hole or something like that, what the pulsar timing community is also looking for very dearly, say?
So this is partially an open question. Exactly where to draw this line has been a matter of debate for years. And this is exactly what I was trying to look at when we looked at this, by looking at numerical relativity simulations at varying mass ratio. So in particular, what we looked at here is the phase of the in-spiral of the numerical relativity simulation as a function of mass ratio and frequency. And you can then do this for many numerical relativity simulations at different mass ratios, and then try to fit what the size of the different coefficients in that expansion. And at least for circular equatorial non-spinning binaries, it turns out that once you fit for the zero and one post-adiabatic terms in this expansion, what you're left with is the noise in your numerical relativity simulation. There's hardly anything to fit beyond that. So this suggests that the coefficients that you have beyond there are very small. So from the step from there of what, if you can use it, for example, for pulsars, is a question of how accurately you would need the dynamics of the pulsar. But in principle, once you're at that regime, the phase error that you would accumulate over an in-spiral time scale would be order of your mass ratio times a order one number. So if the mass ratio is 1 to 100, you're looking at a phase error over the entire in-spiral of maybe a tenth, or maybe 100. Which for, depending for the application, may be more than enough or not enough at all. So for pulsar applications, I'm a bit hesitant to say, because I don't know exactly what accuracy the phase is actually required there.
Well, I'm not really from the pulsar community, but I just know that they have very high accuracy usually in their orbital data.
Yeah,
so but also they use usually the post-Newtonian, first order post-Newtonian expansion. So,
So the other thing about pulsars is, of course, these are usually very much in the weak field regime, where you don't, where the post-Newtonian solutions work very well. Because, yes, I don't think any of the pulsar results actually require things like even 4 p.m. results to be accurate. They're quite happy with like the second post-Newtonian results, I think.